We belong to a tradition that has long valued practice over study. But that doesn't mean that it insisted on no study at all. After all, John Tsao and John Mun read books on the Vinaya, read books on the Tathagata practices, the ascetic practices. And that's what inspired them to go out into the forest. In other words, they took what they read and let that direct them. Of course, they had to find a lot of things that were not mentioned in the texts, clear up a lot of issues that were not there, or that were only vaguely explained. But it was a sign that they knew how to read. If there were questions, they were going to find the answers inside. That's the same way we should learn how to read the text. We're here to practice. As you notice, right now you're sitting with your eyes closed, focused on your breath. You're not focused on a book someplace. But what you're going to do as you're focused on the breath is shaped by what you've read, what you've heard. It's simply a lesson in how to take what you've heard and read and turn it into your own dharma. We think of a teacher like Ajahn Chah, who's noted for his very direct way of speaking. When you read him in Thai, you're really struck by the amount of Pali that he uses, very casually. But he too studied a lot. Ajahn Lee would subscribe to the Dhammacakku magazine that was printed in Bangkok at the time, that had sutta translations, articles on the Dhamma. And during the evening meditation at his monastery in Chandaburi, every month he'd read out what was there in the magazine during their meditation sessions and given the very standardized and formal way in which Pali is translated into Thai. You would wonder to what extent reading out sutra translations would raise more questions than they would answer. You look at Ajahn Lee's writings when he's explaining certain points of doctrine, and they had not only standard Pali lists, but also the standard Thai translations. Those were given in the texts. And coming from a rural area, coming from the forest, there's no way he could say that the standard translations were wrong. But he had his ways of interpreting them. So the standard translations came to make sense. He went on the assumption that they should make sense. And he devoted himself to finding out a way in which they did. That's a good attitude to have as you study and you practice. You listen to some teachings and they point in one direction. You listen to others, they point in another direction. You can either say, well, these teachings don't make any sense and leave it at that. Or you may seem to say, well, they're not meant to make sense. That's what's cool about Buddhism. But that's not really helpful. The helpful attitude is, these things must make sense somehow, and how is it? And John Cha gives a nice example. He says, sometimes you hear me say, go left, go left. Sometimes you hear me say, go right, go right. When I say go left to the people who are falling off the right side of the path, I say go right to the people who are falling off the left side. The teachings are meant to point forward. But sometimes you need to make course adjustments. So an important part of practicing is learning how to read and how to think about what you read. Remembering discernment comes from listening, which includes reading. It also comes from thinking. And then it comes from practice. And although the discernment that's going to make a big change in our mind is the discernment that comes from practice. It has to be informed by how you read and how you think. So go on the assumption that the Dharma makes sense. And if it doesn't seem to make sense, ask yourself how you could look at it another way so that it would. This exercises your own intelligence. Instead of having to ask questions all the time and demand that things be explained. You take some responsibility for your understanding of the Dharma. A case in point is reading about the Buddha, reading about the noble disciples in their quest for awakening. You read about them in different ways. When you read about the Buddha, he was the type of person, as he said, he would teach what was necessary, he would teach what was useful. You look in the canon, there's very little about his life aside from his life of practice. He mentions his wealthy background. Simply as proof that he knew what he was talking about when he talked about sensual pleasures and how the path of sensual pleasures did not lead to true happiness. So he's illustrating a principle. In fact, all of his remarks about his quest for awakening illustrate principles. How self-torture is also not the true path. How going for the formless attainments and just staying there, that's not going to solve the problem. Everything is meant to show how he committed himself to a path of practice and then would reflect on it. As he later said, this is how you find the Dharma, commitment, reflection. And particularly what he learned about the principles of action. When you look at how he would act and then reflect and then make changes. It's an illustration of the causal principle that he finally realized lay at the center of the issue. Of training the mind, which is that some causes arise together with their effects and disappear together. In other cases, the effects come after the cause and disappear after the cause has disappeared. Which means that your actions do have influences over time, but you can also make course changes. You're not stuck in one line of cause and effect. There's always the opportunity of freedom of choice with every moment. And the Buddha's description of how he came to awakening is an illustration of that principle. So we read the Buddha's quest for awakening as general principles that are applicable across the board. When we read about the members of the Sangha, it's different. Here's an illustration of that principle that Venerable Ananda talked about. You read or hear that there are others who have attained awakening. You think they're human beings. They can do it. I'm a human being. I can do it too. And so you read the accounts that are given in the Tarigata and Theravada. And there's a lot of what you might say is superfluous information. People tell us where they came from. Some cases they're very poor, some cases very rich. Some people were very young, other people didn't come to the Dharma. There was one woman who didn't come until after she'd had 10 children, totally worn out. And so on the one hand, that information is superfluous. It has nothing to do with what the Dharma taught. But it does perform a function, it does serve a purpose. Whereas you can read that there's somebody who you can identify with. Either it's because they are like you, have the same gender, have the same background, or it's simply because they're human beings with problems. The idea that women need to read about women, men need to read about men, poor people need to read about poor people, doesn't have much traction in the Buddhist teachings. Because after all, he says, you see somebody who's extremely rich, you've been there. see someone who's extremely poor. You've been there. I know when John Vuong told me the story one time of a man who was extremely poor, who had to fight with himself for hours about simply giving a gift of a cloak to the Buddha. I found it very inspiring. Now, it may have been related to the fact that when I was a child, there were a couple of years when my father was out of work. But we'd never been that poor. But who knows, maybe sometime in the past, in a lifetime that I can't remember, I did suffer from poverty. But still, I found it inspiring. So you find that the individual details may not be that relevant to what you have to do in your practice. They may be there more for the sake of inspiration, that this is a path that's open to everybody, and that the details of your past life really don't have to get in the way of your meditation, which is an important lesson. Now, occasionally some of the accounts of the members of the Sangha's path to awakening will give specific information. There's one passage where Venerable Wakali talks about how he's sick now in the wilderness. He thinks of all the great monks of the past and how they fought off their illnesses with the five strengths, the seven factors for awakening. So that's what he was going to do too. Other sister Sona, who said that when she went to see another nun, asked for the Dharma the nun taught her, aggregates, sense spheres, elements, or properties. So there are some Dharma teachings there. Still, there's not much in detail. The same with the John Mun's life. At the very end of his life, he mentioned that his main teachings were the Four Noble Truths and the Four Establishings of Mindfulness. You read his life story, though, there's very little about those teachings. A lot of other details to give you a sense of inspiration. So remember, when you read the Dharma, read the lives of the Buddha and the members of the Noble Sangha, remember that some teachings are there for instruction and others are there for inspiration. Think of the Buddha's way of giving teachings. He would instruct, but then he would urge, rouse, and encourage. So when you read the Dharma, try to get a sense of which passages are there to instruct you and which ones are there to encourage you. Look for instruction from the first. Take encouragement from the second. And that'll clear up a lot of confusion right there.